Normally, people gravitate toward the things at which they excel. Mark Sanborn, on the other hand, became a professional speaker because he completely botched his first attempt at public speaking, a short speech on safety that he gave at the age of 10 through his local 4-H club. Humiliated but not defeated, young Mark set out to get to the root of his speaking struggles. To say that he succeeded would be an understatement. Mark Sanborn became a professional speaker by the age of 27, with wide experience in sales and marketing, and with the state and national presidencies of the Future Farmers of America already under his belt. Perhaps best known for his best-selling book, The Fred Factor, Mark is not only a past president of the National Speakers Association, but he's also been inducted into NSA's Speaker Hall of Fame. Although Mark is someone who has a very large following, he's always willing to take the time to help those who ask for it. We hope you enjoy this, our intimate and exclusive interview with Mark. And if you enjoy it, you'll definitely enjoy the book for which this interview was conducted, Finding Speaking Success, Mentoring Tips from the Masters. Featuring interviews with other highly successful speakers, including Gina Schreck, Patricia Fripp, Joe Saba, and Charles Phoenix. You can purchase a copy for yourself exclusively through www.50interviews.com.
My name is Mark Sanborn. I'm the president of Sanborn Associates, Inc., which I call an idea studio for leadership development. The two primary ways that I work in leadership development are through speaking and writing. My speaking and writing drive the development of our training resources, which are an important part of our business, DVD-based training that our clients can use to facilitate their own in-house sessions. I am located in Highlands Ranch, Colorado. I'm a past president of the National Speakers Association. I hold the CSP, which is the Certified Speaking Professional designation from the National Speakers Association, and also I'm a member of the Speaker Hall of Fame. The CSP is an earned designation. The Hall of Fame is an honor conferred by colleagues. It's called the CPAE, which stands for Council of Peers Award of Excellence, but in more common vernacular, it's the Speaker Hall of Fame. I was also honored to be a recipient of the CAVIT, which is the highest honor in the organization, which is based on service to the speaking profession and to the National Speakers Association. And although I'm proud and humbled by all those designations, the award for service in the spirit of CAVIT means a great deal to me because I knew CAVIT personally. He was the founder of the National Speakers Association. When I first got into speaking was at an amateur level when I was 10. I was a member of 4-H. I entered on behalf of my club, the Happy Hayseeds. I'm not making that up. Growing up on a dairy farm, I entered the safety speaking contest. I had to give a 3 to 5 minute speech. I thought, how hard could it be? The answer is, it was real hard. I did really bad. And frankly, that's what got me interested in speaking. I really think if I had done okay or done well, that would have been the first and only speech contest I would have ever entered. I had such a sense of burning humiliation that I was going to learn how to do this. The reason that's important is because there are a lot of youth organization speaking competitions, service clubs like Rotary International and various organizations that give young people a chance to develop speaking skills. And I spent much of my childhood doing that, speaking in churches, civic groups, and clubs. So by the time I was in college, having served as the state president of the Future Farmers of America, a lot of people heard me speak. And so at the age of 19, I gave my first paid speech. It was $150, which doesn't sound like a lot until you remember I was in college back in the early 80s, and that was about 2 weeks shift work at a Wendy's restaurant. So compared to smelling like a French fry, it wasn't a bad way to make some money to pay for books and tuition. I went full-time at the age of 27. I got my degree in agricultural economics. I did spend 6.5 years in sales and marketing because I think that it's very, very important to be a practitioner of what you speak about. And that's something we'll, I'm sure, potentially come to later, but because I speak on leadership, I have been very involved in serving on boards of directors, leading not just my own small business, but being involved at the national level in leadership positions. I think that's really important to the credibility of speakers. Today, speaking at a professional level is too competitive to just be given book reports and observing from afar. So that is an important part of my background. I don't speak about things I haven't been involved in doing. I started off for the first couple of years doing public seminars.
So workshops?
Yeah, through seminar companies. There are still some. The business is dramatically different now than it was then. It was a little easier to make a livelihood in the public seminar business, but I around 1989 or 90, started working exclusively with my own clients.
But you initially were teaching someone else's curriculum?
Well, I was teaching someone else's course, but it was often a mix of their kind of bulleted points and my material as a trainer, as a speaker. It was kind of a hybrid because there was a structure you had to deliver on, but frankly, to be successful, you had to be really good at providing your own illustrations. I mean, they gave you the bones, if you will, and you provided the muscle and flesh for the program. But one of the things that I have learned that is critically important is that you emulate to learn, but you innovate to earn. Well, if there's other speakers that do the same material you do, you'll never make significant feats. When I started in the business, at one time I was approved to do, through the public seminar company at the time, Tom Peters, In Search of Excellence. And I remember thinking, and I'm a fan of Tom's work, but I remember thinking, you know, every time somebody quoted Tom Peters, Tom's fee went up and theirs stayed the same. So all of the intellectual property that I speak on now, I've developed. I don't use other people's material, even in the early days, other than when I was in high school and college and quoting Zig Ziglar. And today, if I do quote, if I do use someone's material, I attribute it.
If you had to guess how many times you've spoken at this point in your career?
Somewhere between 2,300 and 2,400 paid presentations. If you counted the unpaid, I couldn't begin to tell you, but paid 2,300 to 2,400.
And the largest audience you've ever spoken in front of?
22,000.
Wow. Where was that?
Well, when I was president of the FFA at the national level, we had H. Roe Bartle Arena in Kansas City, combined live and video-fed viewership of around 21, 22,000. Typically, audiences would range from a couple hundred to a couple thousand. That would be a typical corporate audience these days. But audience size is really misleading. It doesn't really indicate much more than the thrill of being in front of a lot of people, because I've been in front of audiences of 10 exceedingly high-powered multi-millionaire CEOs, and I've been in front of audiences of hundreds that were entry-level employees. So audience size is not something that I think really figures in too heavily to what most speakers do.
How many times a year are you speaking now?
Typically 50 to 70, 50 to 60 paid engagements, and then because of the books that I write and the ministry and pro bono work that I do, there's probably another 10 or so engagements that would be unpaid, appearance, promotional, and or pro bono.
So a little more than once a week.
It works out to 1 week home, 4 days out, home a day, out a day, back in for three, in and out for two. So the busiest speaking months are mid-January through the end of June, and then September through November. Because as you might imagine, for a corporate speaker, which I primarily am, the middle of summer, lots of vacations, few meetings. After Thanksgiving, it's the holidays, and again, there are meetings, but they're not nearly as many.
What is your average speaking fee now?
$20,000 for a keynote.
How much time percentage do you spend between these three items? Trying to get booked as a speaker, creating the content, and then actually speaking.
I'm going to hedge a little bit on that because I'm a bit of an anomaly in that 22 of my 23 years, I never had a full-time person doing business development. My philosophy was always to be so good when I was in front of an audience. That was the goal, that someone or more than one person in the audience would hear me and hire me. So I worked for the majority of my career on referrals and repeat business. Periodically, we would do something that might be construed as outbound marketing. We might make a mailing. But for the most part, I worked with speakers bureaus, especially in the early days of my business. I had great relationships and still do a lot of bureaus. And mostly responded to inquiries. I would call that reactive marketing, and I don't say that to be vain or pompous, but you know, I wouldn't necessarily even recommend that, but that's what worked for me. Even though I have a background in sales and marketing, I've always been far more interested in the craft of designing and delivering and working with clients than I have in obtaining clients. And one of the things that I think is a takeaway is that I still believe you should put your product first and promotion second. It's much easier to promote and sell a good product than it is to be a good promoter of a bad product. Sometimes speakers can fall into the trap of having a marginal or a passing product that they just, through shock and awe, promote, but find that their cost of sale is very high because they're not getting the word of mouth, referral, repeat business.
between the creating and the actual presenting, if you had to split that percentage up?
It's changed a bit over the years, but the second thing that I became, I think, well known for based on client feedback is I really tailor. I don't just drop the client's name in or the name of their product. And this was started back before the internet, so it was a little harder. But I did a lot of backgrounding so that one of the kind of highest compliments I would get is, wow, people thought you worked here. Now, I don't ever position myself as knowing more than they do. But I want them to know that I didn't just take material that was given a week ago for the Kiwanis or the Elks Lodge and drop it on them. I think one of the great skills of a good speaker is to make it easy for people to apply their ideas. And so I was always investing, based on what my colleagues either told me or observed, more time in not just writing and developing material, but tailoring it to the specific audience. I really, after, 23 years, can't give you a real breakdown, but I would say there's far more time spent developing and preparing than there ever is delivering.
Is it a day, a week, for a big talk that you give?
Well, now, after 23 years, anything you do, it's like, I'm sure Tiger Woods still practices, but practices differently. I still prepare, but I prepare differently because I have the benefit of all those years of learning how to do it in an expedient, efficient manner.
I was just thinking, how much time would you typically budget to prepare for a speak that you just got booked for?
60 hours, maybe. In the early days, you want to be good? Yeah. It's kind of like, I'm sure, to hit a long drive, you hit 10 buckets of golf balls, and now to hit a long drive, you might have to hit, one bucket of golf balls. So that changes over time.
Your thoughts on speaker bureaus, you actually touched on it. Are there any ones you specifically recommend?
Bureaus are like speakers. There's really good ones, there's a few not so good ones, and everything in between. And the key thing for what makes a bureau good, in my opinion, is how they treat the speakers they book and how they treat the clients they work with. And if a client loves a bureau and the bureau truly acts like a partner, that is to say, they don't just see booking you as an economic transaction, but that they really are interested in the right person in front of the right audience, then there's many excellent bureaus. There are some bureaus I've known that book me that I don't know well. There are some bureaus that I've known for years and have a beer with and never book me. And then there are bureaus that like me and drink beer with me and book me. It's a mix. They're a great resource because there's an association of bureaus, IASB, the International Association of Speakers Bureaus, that has a code of ethics and that works very closely with the National Speakers Association to create that kind of reciprocal professional relationship.
What do you attribute your success to, and did you have a mentor early on?
I attribute my success to the decidedly unsexy notion of hard work and combined with a love of the craft. You can become successful and you can probably become good as a mechanic, but I've always tried to combine, mechanics and artistry. There's very few things now at this age and stage in my life that I'd like to do better than play with ideas and figure out effective ways to communicate them through stories. You can work hard, but without that kind of fundamental commitment and passion, you're going to be limited. You can have a great deal of passion, and if you don't work hard, you're going to be limited too. A gallon of gas with no engine doesn't get you very far, so you've got to have both. I have had many mentors, some what I would call mentors at a distance, people that I watched, and I said, wow. I think picking a mentor is you have to pick someone early on when you're more in the emulation stage, someone whose style is similar to yours. It doesn't do a lot of good to have a mentor who has a radically different style or a radically different philosophy. You can learn from anyone. I'm not saying you can only learn from like-minded people. That's kind of not true, but I think you need to pick your mentors carefully, and you can't force a mentor relationship. They have to be willing to invest in you, and I've been blessed with many good mentors from early on that are still friends, and I have been even more blessed to have been, in the last 10, 20 years, approached by people and to have served as a mentor. I don't have enough hours in the day to mentor everyone, but there's that relationship that's developed. It's a real treat to be able to help shorten their learning curve by building into what they're doing.
Early for you, I'm curious who some of your mentors are, the people that you looked up to early in your...
I was always affected by kind of the simple eloquence of Billy Graham, having watched him from the time I was a kid. Anybody that is my age that had an interest in professional speaking wasn't as familiar with the early superstars, Zig Ziglars, the Og Mandinos, the Tommy Hopkins. I was fortunate because in college, one of my mentors was a guy named Mike Frank, who runs a small speakers bureau in Columbus, Ohio. I did a little bit of selling for Mike. He used to do public seminars. And I met and worked with backstage, not on stage at the time, but I met and worked with Zig and Norman Vincent-Peale and Tommy Hopkins and Og Mandino.
Wow.
And then later, through the National Speakers Association, because I joined at such a young age, I served on the board of directors with some of them. Og Mandino, my wife had taken a picture of Og at an NSA event and sent it to him, and Og had sent Darla and I a handwritten thank you note that arrived on the day I was on the road, on the day that, regrettably, we learned of his passing. It wasn't spooky, but it made me pause. My assistant at the time said, "Got bad news, Og Mandino passed away," and what's really weird is there's a letter from Og on your desk. So I really, with only a handful of exceptions, met a lot of the people who were and still are my heroes. Now, there's been a lot of new talent, and I've gotten to know who they are. I mean, I know a lot of the people who are my best friends or my staunchest competitors. I mean, I've got buddies out there that if they get a gig that I was up for, I'll know I'll probably get it next time, and I may get a gig they were up for and actually refer them next time. So there's no circuit anymore. That's another myth, you know. There was a circuit at one time. GM and others sponsored literally a speaking circuit, almost a Chautauqua circuit. Now, there's just a whole lot of meetings. And if you're a busy speaker and you have certain topics and certain audiences, you run into people and you know who's out there making a living and doing a good job and getting asked back.
We hope you're enjoying our interview with Mark Sanborn, and we'll come back to it in a moment. We wanted to share a brief word about 50 Interviews. Where you are today is likely the result of years of hard work. No doubt you've learned some things along the way that probably would have helped you had you known them earlier. What if early in your career or endeavor you had sought out and interviewed 50 successful individuals in that niche? Do you think they would have shared a few painful lessons they learned along the way? Maybe helped you avoid the same mistakes? The opportunity to have a one-on-one conversation with someone we admire is one of the most beautiful connections we will ever make. A basic human instinct is to share advice and offer others encouragement. Deep down, our beliefs are strongly influenced by those around us. Our beliefs, in turn, impact our decisions, which, in a large part, determine our place in life. The greater purpose of 50 Interviews is simple. If you're not where you want to be, surround yourself with those who are. The act of taking the spoken interview into a published work provides the author access into the minds of some of the greatest individuals they will ever meet. Recording your interviews for the world to read or hear gives those we've had the privilege of interviewing the knowledge that the time they spent with you was worthwhile and that the insights they've shared will be passed along to others. 50 Interviews provides authors a framework to turn passion into action and ultimately transforms the author into a credible expert in his or her field. If you'd like to learn more about becoming a 50 Interviews author, please visit www.50interviews.com.
Are you a member of the NSA, and how has the membership benefited you?
Well, you know, that's been the single biggest help to accelerating my success are the relationships, the things I learned and the relationships I formed. I mean, NSA's espoused mission in 2009 is to provide education and community. We don't say that just because you're a member of NSA, that means you're a better speaker. That's kind of a backwards claim. That's like saying if you join the Republican Party, you're a better politician, or if you join the Democratic Party, you're a better politician. What we say is, if you join NSA, the organization will help make you a better speaker. How? Through providing a community of friends and support, encouragement, and providing just really leading-edge educational content. Now, one of the things we're always careful to say in NSA is, hey, don't join NSA, you're not going to get bookings. It's not a speaker's bureau. We don't invite people to come to see you speak so they can hire you. Having said that, however, I can tell you I have gotten booked because people who knew me through NSA and were familiar with my work were comfortable suggesting me. That's true of any profession. When you know someone does good work and you have a client, clients often ask me, they say, you know a lot of speakers, here's what we're looking for. And it'll be something pretty esoteric, something I don't do, wouldn't try to do. Not only do I know who does it, but probably through my work in NSA, I know how well they do it. So NSA is unequivocally been one of the great resources for me, both personally and professionally. Some of my best friends in the business are NSA members, and I continue to learn a great deal.
What are you doing now in your speaking business that you thought it should have started doing sooner?
Well, it's going to date me, but undoubtedly the single most important thing I didn't do well, and we're just coming late to the party, is this whole contact management thing. I mean, we did use databases, but we didn't really cultivate at a contact management level the ability to track and stay in touch with just clients. But now, you know, everybody from blog readers to, you know, the social media, that's a new phenomenon within the last 24 months. So I would say the big umbrella for me, whenever somebody says, what's the one thing you wish you'd have done better? No doubt about it. I wish I'd have been much more scientific and strategic about contact management. We don't cold call, but people who have done business with you and bought from you obviously are valued relationships, and the ability to stay in touch with those people in an appropriate way is critical. So your promo, your marketing, and your relationship building is only as good as your contact management system.
Now, when you speak, is it appropriate to ask for contact information of the people who attended?
We don't. There are some speakers that do. What we typically do is we try to give people an incentive to raise their hand. But my office and I make available our website and encourage people to sign up for our e-zine. We do a very content-focused e-zine. It's not just an ad. And so we tell people if they want to stay in touch with me, what I'm speaking about, what I'm thinking, there's the e-zine, there's the blog, there's Facebook, there's Twitter. So we give people a way to say it's okay for you to have at least our email. But that's a pretty casual relationship. We do obviously now have, you know, a good contact management system for live prospects and current and former clients.
It's a lot easier to capture that information now compared
a whole lot easier.
So that leads next into the question of how's the internet helped you, and I think you definitely touched on that. And are you tapping into social media now? It sounds like you definitely are. Have you seen a benefit from that yet?
Yeah, it's a little hard to quantify. I think that right at the moment, and I do think there are very specific benefits, but I think that at the very least, the benefit of social media is it extends your impact and influence to people who want to be impacted and influenced by it. You know, it's not like writing an email list of 100,000 people who like self-help books and hoping that 114 of them will respond to your offer. These are people who, again, give you a chance to make yourself known and, I think, also to demonstrate value. I think if you can demonstrate value before anyone pays you, they're more likely to pay you. In other words, if I already know that what you say and write and do is useful, and I know that because I follow you on Twitter and I'm connected to you on Facebook or Plaxo, I'm much more likely, when I have the opportunity to engage a speaker or buy a book, to go, I know that guy or that gal's good. That's ultimately
builds credibility.
Yeah, I mean, there's the personal and the professional aspect of Facebook. I'm much more about sharing ideas than I am about just talking about, although I do occasionally say I just walked our tiny dogs. But, you know, I mean, you got to maintain some of your humanity, but I don't use it like today I'm brushing my teeth now and, you know, I'm headed out the door to grab breakfast at Black Eyed Pea or, you know, wherever that may be.
So, and one of the things that is, if you open a Facebook account, are you prepared to handle the flood of people that want to talk to you? And it's just like, you know, when you get to 200-300 emails a day, how do you possibly keep up with?
Well, the good news about Facebook and Twitter is it's a passive media. That is to say that
people don't expect necessarily.
Yeah, people can comment without the expectation of a response. Typically, if they want a response, they let you know that it's either a message or an email. And email is indeed a challenge. You know, I mean, I'm a little nostalgic for when I didn't have 200 or 300 email messages a day. However, when you think about it, we still had the need to connect with people. We were writing letters and licking envelopes, and we were making more phone calls. So, if anything, there's probably a net savings in time. I think that the internet's probably made us a little more efficient. So, even though it may seem like a ball and chain, compared to when I started in business, you know, having a stack of letters that I had to type out with an IBM Selectric and use whiteout to change a mistake, that's a whole different age.
What are the biggest mistakes that you see new speakers make?
Well, for me, it's charging too much too soon. The belief that you can charge, that anybody can charge, that's like saying I sell DVD players. And somebody calls me and says, what are you selling for? And I say, $99. They say, great, I'll buy one. And then I hang up the phone and go, God, now I got to figure out how to build the damn thing. I've never built a DVD player before. Right. And that's as nonsensical as saying you're a speaker. The way you find out when you should be charging is, one way is pretty simple, and that is when you give a presentation for free somewhere, and someone comes up and says, what do you charge? That's the universe's way of saying, somebody thinks you're worth hiring. Now, that doesn't mean you can charge anything you want, but at least you know there's some economic value associated with what you do. There's exceptions. You know, if you won a gold medal in the Olympics, or you won a war, or you walked on the moon, I mean, obviously, these are celebrity speakers. But for most of us that aren't celebrities, it's about people saying your ideas and the way you present them have an economic value to me. So that's, to me, the big mistake, is charging either too soon or charging too much too soon. For a new speaker to get established in the business, the key is to be in front of as many audiences as you possibly can as frequently as you can.
Speak for free. It was Larry Kendall said he spoke for 10 years for free.
Well, you know, I mean, I was weird because I had the youth thing going on. But, you know, people think even though I started in the business at 27, I had been speaking in front of audiences regularly since 10. That's 17 years. I mean, you know, I don't want to suggest that being in front of the, you know, 4-H club is the same as being in front of IBM. Yeah, but it's
burned your stripes.
Yeah.
What is the most difficult aspect of your career to keep under control, and how do you stay balanced? You've certainly maintained your health.
It wasn't always that way. You know, early on when I was doing, I did 156 six-hour seminars my first full year in the business, and, you know, I drank too much, and I weighed too much, and I ate badly. And when you're on the road a lot, the only thing you can do legally and ethically and morally is eat and drink, you know, and even that gets edgy if you do too much of it. But I, a long time ago, formulated this simple idea that it's hard to live a high-performance life in a low-performance body. Best summarized by Jack LaLanne, who's 90-something and still works out 2 hours a day. Jack LaLanne in an interview once said, you know, I put a lot in so I can take a lot out. And that's kind of how I am. I think that, you know, we take care of our health and hopefully our sanity so that we have more to give our audiences, our families, our friends. So the biggest challenge as any business grows is details. Details will make you or break you. A lot of speakers think that speaking is their calling. And I say, that may be true, but if you don't treat it as a business, you won't get to practice your calling, unless you want to do it for free. So details continue, you know, to be potential fly in the ointment. And there are a lot of moving parts. You know, I always tell people, being in front of the audience is the easiest part. Getting there, getting to the airport, to the hotel, checking the room, the sound, the details. Mm. You know, I often say you win or lose before you ever hit the stage. At a performance level, by being prepared, but also at a practical level, in that once you're on stage, you can't screw with the lights. You can't adjust, you know, the temperature if the heat's deadly. You can't deal with a jackhammer that is breaking up concrete in the meeting room next door.
Who is your ideal audience, and what do you hope your audience takes away from your talks?
An ideal audience is any audience that wants to work with me to create a great presentation. You know, it's not just about the speaker. You can do a great job and have an off audience, and it can be a mediocre outcome. You can give a mediocre speech to a great audience and have a pretty good outcome. But the best presentations are a combination of the speaker and the audience. That, to me, is an ideal audience, an audience that wants to be there, an audience that's already favorably predisposed and interested. You don't always control that. But for me, a typical audience are business leaders or leaders. I do a lot of work with not just for-profits, but nonprofits, associations, church, university leaders. I mean, my target audience are people who have leadership positions or who want to be influencers and don't have leadership positions, which is why I wrote You Don't Need a Ton to Be a Leader. But that's my typical audience. But an ideal audience is an audience that is engaged. There's things you can do to keep an audience engaged, but ultimately, it's a cooperative effort.
And what do you hope they take away when you're done speaking?
What I hope everybody takes away is, first, you know, that they're encouraged to either keep doing the things they have been doing that they should be doing, or to start doing the things they should be doing they haven't been doing. I mean, you know, I think encouragement is a very simple but powerful gift. But more importantly, you know, people need three things. They need the what, the why, and the how. And so that's always what I try to design around. I want to give people not just the here's what you should do, because you can tell people what to do, but if they don't know how to do it or they don't have a reason to do it, it's moot. So you got to give them the what and the why. There's got to be compelling reasons that make sense to them, not just to you. You know this if you got kids. Kids do things for reasons not just their parents, but for their own. And then you've got to give them the applicable. You know, corporate America loves the word actionable, which is a little rigid, but actionable. People want ideas they can use. And that, to me, is one of my goals, to give people ideas they can use to be better at what they do, whether it's parenting or leading or whatever.
How are you able to keep your content fresh and new, and especially if you're booking repeat engagements with the same audiences?
Well, first of all, I keep a record of what I tell audiences so that when I go back, I don't have to rely on my limited memory. I mean, that's an easy one.
So record everything you
do. I don't record it in the sense of an audio or video, but I keep notes. I don't use notes ever when I speak. I shouldn't say that. Maybe once or twice in 2 or 3 years. But what I do is I make notes in preparation so that at the end of the speech, I go back to the notes I made, write down what I added that I didn't have in my notes, or cross out what I had in my notes that I didn't use. So I always have a record, a general record of every speech I've given. But the way that I keep material fresh is I write a lot. I mean, you know...
Never stop writing.
Whether you publish or you just write for your personal use, whether it's journaling or blogging, the big benefit there isn't necessarily you're going to write a best-selling book, but it forces you to come up with new ideas. You got to have a discipline that gets you to not just have experiences, but extract the lessons, not just what you learn, but what your audience can learn from it. Creative output, whether it's writing or note-taking or journaling, whatever it may be, that's critical. And the key thing is if your material's not fresh to you, it's not going to be fresh to your audience. So I've got material that my audience has never heard that I don't use anymore just because it's just kind of frozen in time. It doesn't float my boat. Just don't use it anymore. And to be fresh to the audience, it's got to be fresh to me.
So what's next for you, Mark? Where do you see yourself in 10 years? And is there anything you haven't done yet that you hope to do before you die?
Well, there's a lot of stuff I hope to do before I die at a family, personal, professional level. But for me, as a person who's deeply interested in leadership, it's about increasing my influence, positive influence, you know, because there's negative influence. So, you know, you can use influence for ill gain. But it's about increasing my platform so that my ideas, whether they're written or spoken, whatever form they take, will have a bigger platform to positively impact more people. And that's a very simple goal, but obviously a very difficult one to pull off, too.
Biggest challenge you face as someone making a full-time profession from speaking, whether it's on or off the stage, and how have you overcome those challenges? Are there things that you've learned along the way that have really kind of helped you make this full-time career work? Because I think that not everybody's able to sustain an entire career out of speaking.
Or chooses to. I mean, you know, the longer you travel, no matter how much you like what you do, in this age of travel, it's rarely much fun. At best, it's okay. And at worst, it's painful. But for me, I tell audiences, and I've learned it myself, is nobody has time for anything. You make time for the important stuff. You become disciplined to the point that you stop letting circumstance control what you do and you start choosing what you do. I think it was Aristotle or Emerson who said you should rouse yourself from unexamined habit. And so many people today confuse activity with accomplishment. I've gotten much better in the last 10 or 15 years of my life at focusing on accomplishment, that is, what of significance I'm achieving versus how busy I am. Now, sometimes being busy is just an excuse or an anesthesia for not doing what you need to do. So we don't have time. I don't know anybody that's got an extra 2 or 3 hours a day and they go, I'm going to use those 2 or 3 hours to write a book, get healthy, work out, spend time with my family. I mean, you make the time. You displace other stuff so they have the time to do what needs to be done.
Your most embarrassing or humbling moment while speaking?
Oh, you know, I've had so many. In the speaking profession, I was with a group of colleagues once. I was particularly young and naive. Now I'm old and naive. But back then, I was particularly young, and I got caught up in how much I thought I knew and made a statement about an organization, only to find out that one of the people in the group was a member of that particular organization. And obviously, it's been probably 30 years, and if I can still remember 30 years later, it made quite an impression on me. The biggest danger, I think, in professional speaking is to become too self-absorbed, take ourselves too seriously. We obviously take our work, our messages seriously, but, you know, whenever we become too full of ourselves, there are people standing by ready to help us come back to reality. For me, it's my kids, my wife, my friends. An interesting thing on a humorous level is that not that long ago, I was speaking to a very powerful group of executives. I cut myself shaving that morning. It took me a couple hours to stop bleeding. And right in the middle of my speech, I started again, big drops of blood. And you do the only thing you can do. I mean, you know, you acknowledge, hey, this is something I can't control. I carry a handkerchief. I put it over the offending cut and finished my speech. And at the end, was able to kind of make light of it in a funny way. And I'm not sure the audience would have chosen that I did that, bled on stage. But in a funny way, I think it increased the rapport because, you know, I say in my work with speakers, perfection is never perfect. To be perfect on stage is imperfect because nobody's perfect. Nobody's natural. Nobody's normal. And certainly I think people go, you know, I've never cut myself in blood on stage, but boy, he must have the same kind of days I have. And just stuff goes wrong and I don't have anything I can do about it.
What have been the most rewarding aspects of your speaking career?
Well, I learned that you can't really help an audience. An audience is an impersonal mass of people, but you help individuals. And so the high points are always when a person, not just the meeting planner speaking for the group, but when an individual comes up and thanks you for something specific that helped them, that's the gratifying part of the profession. Getting an email, there's a fellow that I've been emailing with that heard me speak at the beginning of my career 20 years ago, and he's approaching 80 and periodically emails, just a great guy. And to have that kind of connection with people through the power of initially, you know, not knowing me from a box of rocks and seeing me stand in front of a group for a few hours is very gratifying.
So what would it say on your tombstone?
While he lived, he loved. Because he loved, he served. When he served, he led.
So is there anything else I didn't ask that you think an aspiring speaker, somebody that thinks they want to get into this, should know?
It used to bother me when people would say, I want to buy a cup of coffee and pick your brain because I want to be a speaker. They'd hear me speak, you know. And I've never said to my surgeon, you know, I buy a coffee and find out how you take gallbladders out. The difference being that in speaking, typically there isn't an education. There are some universities that offer speaking accreditation. But for the most part, these are skill sets. And what dawned on me is when somebody says that they want to be a speaker, you made it look easy. Mastery makes it look easy. And so in a funny way, the highest compliment is when somebody sees you do what you do and goes, hey, that can't be that hard. That he made it look fun, she made it look exciting, I want to do that. Now, we've all seen speakers that we said, thank you God, that ain't me. By the grace of God, I'm not standing in front of this group dying. Mastery makes it look easy, so the better anyone becomes at what they do, the easier they make it look. And that does kind of place tricks, I think, on newer speakers' minds. They don't realize the number of hours that went into the polish and the performance. I'm sure there are people who have, you know, the genetic makeup that makes it perhaps easier for them, but I don't know of anybody that's born a professional speaker. You know, you can be tall and not be a basketball player. You can be fast and not be a track star. So it's a combination of genetics and gifting and hard work.
Have you leveraged the PR or the media? Has that really made a difference in your career?
The biggest impact on my business in the last 4 or 5 years was a best-selling book. You know, the Fred Factor sold 400+ thousand copies in the U.S. and over 1,000,001 worldwide. You know, we say having a book is the best marketing tool. Well, it's a good marketing tool. Having a best-selling book is a really good marketing tool because, you know, I can't begin to tell you how much that's driven our business, both in speaking and demand for my resources. Fred Factor wasn't my first book, and depending on how you count it, it's probably my third or fourth book, and that means I got 3 or 4 nobody ever heard of. Mm. The other thing, though, is that the PR, certainly done right, can be helpful, but PR always has to leverage an event. You can't leverage a concept. You know, okay. My buddy Eric Chester, who has specialized for years in Generation Y, you know, new employees, when, regrettably, the tragedy of Columbine hit, he didn't do PR, but he did 50 or 60 TV appearances. He wasn't exploiting anything. It was just the media turned to somebody who had more insight into kids than others. And so certainly when there's an event, for instance, if you were one of the guys on the boat the Somali pirates captured and you wanted to launch a speaking career, hey, PR could be helpful. But for the average person without a hook, without an event, something new, I'm aware of a number of fast food restaurants in my neighborhood. I don't like their food. I think it sucks. So I don't go there just because I see the ad. It's got to be event driven.
Any books or resources? You definitely mentioned the NSA as being a
strong thing. There's a pretty good book my friend Jane Atkinson wrote. And it's a nice little compendium, and it's called The Wealthy Speaker. And the website is www.speakerlauncher.com. She knows where if she speaks.
We hope you enjoyed this excerpt from the book Finding Speaking Success, Mentoring Tips from the Masters, which features interviews with 26 prominent speakers. Visit www.50speakers.com to learn more and to download a free condensed version of this interview. Again, the mission of 50 interviews is to provide you with a straightforward but highly effective structure to become a credible expert based on your conversation skills, not your writing skills. Visit www.50interviews.com for more information. Thanks for listening, and all the best for your continued success.